Welcome to Productivity Mastery. Stoy here, a productivity and performance coach on a mission to help businesses and people get the most out of their time. On this podcast, I'll bring you exceptional performers and together unlock what it takes to perform at your highest level. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy this episode. Good evening in Europe and good morning in the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Toya and I'm a productivity coach and a co-author of the book, Perform the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. And you're listening to Productivity Mastery Podcast. And I'm very honored and humbled to be here today with one of the most prolific writers of our time, Adam Fisher. I had the pleasure to meet Adam actually at the hotel breakfast in Estonia, where both of us were speakers at a conference called Startup Day. Let's give them a shout out. Startup Day, thank you guys for connecting so many people around the world. So Adam and I hit it up and we had a really good time during the conference. We spoke about a lot of different things and I'm super, super excited to be here with Adam because, wow, this guy is just amazing. The kind of things he's been doing, the kind of people he's been hanging out with, and she's just so humble and a good guy. So Adam, how are you this morning?
Oh, I'm great. Got up on the right side of bed this morning.
Love it. So Adam, why don't you share with the audience a little bit about yourself? Who are you? Where do you come from? And just give a bit of context about who you are.
Oh yeah. So I grew up in Silicon Valley. I had like what I thought was a normal childhood, but turned out to be not. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, and I was hanging out at a little electronics shop called Radio Shack and making my own little blinky light circuits with IDs, and playing a lot with computers. My good friend had an Apple II. I remember opening it up and putting in the ROM chip and it have lowercase. I remember playing games on it. I had a IBM PC, the first one, which was just called the PC. I programmed, taught myself how to program on that. And, just basically geeked out in the suburbs. And then I grew up, decided I wanted to be a writer, moved to New York and lived downtown and worked in the magazine industry. You know, it was a lot of New York based stuff, Village Voice, Details, Esquire, but I eventually became an editor at Wired magazine in its glory days.
How do you become an editor of Wired magazine? What did it really take to make it? I mean, it's a very competitive industry.
Luck. So when Wired was founded out in San Francisco, which is unusual for magazines in the United States. Most of them are in New York or eventually moved to New York, but Wired came out of San Francisco, and they had perfect timing. They established themselves right before the dot-com boom. Everybody realized they had to learn something about what was going on in Silicon Valley and San Francisco at the time, and they ordered Wired. At that point, Wired realized they need some New York-trained people, the economy was booming, and no real editors in magazine editors in New York knew anything about computers. They were all English majors, and some of them were even poetry majors, and they were pretty much uniformly scared of computers. And I was what was called a fact checker at the time, and I somehow came to Wired's attention because I said, oh yeah, I know how to program. That's easy. That's my childhood. And they took a chance on me, made me a features editor, and my career just took off because I had the right background, both New York magazine experience, a real familiarity with Silicon Valley.
And did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Oh, being a magazine editor was kind of the greatest job of the era, I thought. I mean, all the pleasure of writing, because you came up with the ideas, but none of the grueling work of putting words in a row and trying to make sense. So, I gotta interact with all my favorite writers and with the artists and the art department and pull the whole thing together. And all I had to write was the snappy headline.
And you're a writer, you're a journalist, you have to write a lot. What really makes a difference when it comes to delivering on deadlines? Like many creative people struggle to find creativity when they're put into short deadlines. How did it work for you? What helped you to be not just a great journalist, but an effective writer?
Well, the fact that if I didn't produce and didn't make my deadlines, the fact that I would go broke and be evicted and end up on the street homeless, or more likely borrowing money from my parents, was a big motivator. And so you learn to that you cannot rely on inspiration. You learn you got to just show up. It's about what they call it's just getting your seat in the chair, getting that cup of coffee, turning everything off, and staring at the screen until something happens.
Is that your kind of a, we're gonna go and talk about some of the books that you've written, but is that part of your routine? Like I remember Stephen King has some of these routines, and even there was a quote by him, a famous quote that he says, amateurs wait and sit for inspiration while the professionals just gets to work and gets it done. And he had this thing of no matter what, every morning at the same time, I get my cup of coffee and I put myself to write for 4 hours. And sometimes the first 1 hour, I don't come up with anything, but because I have the discipline, I actually get it done. I get into it and I deliver on the pages that I set myself to.
It's absolutely true. I mean, for creative work, it's not true if you're a manager or like an editor or something where you're trying to organize things and pull a lot of elements together. But if one of those elements is the creative element and you're responsible for that, you gotta have just hours in a row and like goals. How many words am I going to write? It's an iterative process. So like if it's not good the first time, you're going to rewrite it anyway. I mean, I wouldn't show it to your boss or editor the first time, but the next day, you can rewrite it again and again, and it starts to get in your head, and you do maybe occasionally wake up with some inspiration or an aha moment, and it does power. You can take that and power through because you have this foundation of all the kind of the basics already on paper, and that is just a schedule. And the one I chose was very boring, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. I'm at my desk trying to concentrate no matter what. I just pick those hours because I have a kid and a wife who has school and regular jobs, so it kind of works. But the other part of it is sleep and exercise, and taking some time off to just clear your head. You can't, I know a guy, every time he gets a book contract, he just locks himself in a hotel room until it's done, and just lives on takeout, and coffee and beer. And like that works too. You can't have a family.
What I'm actually interested about is more your way of doing things, because as you said, there's some people that really go extreme and they actually deliver many times they deliver,
But they burn out.
but they burn out.
Yeah.
And you said the family, the social life, the mental, physical, and spiritual health, if you may, that could suffer. So I'm curious to learn more about what you do,
yeah.
Adam, and how you do it, you know?
The way you create balance is you only have a couple things that you care about. So for me, it's my health, it's my family, and it's my work, right? Like, you know, you can't, you know, there's a famous saying, you know, choose like the four things, the five things that you want to like accomplish in your life, and then throw away two through five, you know, like you got to just focus on one thing.
When was it for you when you decided I want to write books?
Oh, I clearly remember the moment that I wanted to be a writer, and it was in college, and I was trying to figure out, I got a degree essentially in Marxism. That's what they called it, literary theory, but it was kind of intellectual European kind of Marxist philosophy transposed into the United States. So it's pretty abstract and probably nonsense, you know, but maybe not. Anyway, it had zero value in the marketplace. And it also, and so I had to figure out what I was going to do as graduation was approaching. I had to figure out what I wanted to do. And I, you know, the rational thing would be for me to become a lawyer. That's what a lot of people in my kind of position did. You know, you work with words. There's, you know, there's a lot of money in law. The track is very clear. But I just remember thinking, like, you know, I only have one shot. Like, what's the high risk, high reward thing to do? And I was always a bookworm. And I thought, I just want to be a writer. And which is ironic because I was a terrible writer in college, terrible. And I didn't know the first thing about being, I didn't know any writers. I'd studied dead writers, but I didn't know any. And all I knew is that every writer that I'd ever studied lived in New York for a certain amount of time. And so I just moved to New York, and kind of lucked into a job, you know, at a magazine, but it's literally like, you know, I was opening mail, serving coffee, you know. One of my first job titles was copy boy. That was the job title. And I, you know, I had a fancy education. I considered myself an adult. So you really had to start at the bottom at that time. And there was kind of a guild system in journalism at that time, which no longer exists, but at that time. And then I slowly kind of worked my way up to be something called a fact checker, which is again a menial position. I you know, my first job in New York, I was making $17,000 or $18,000 a year and living on it. It was pretty tough, very tough. And then I had a lucky break because I just happened to grow up in Silicon Valley, and the .com thing was happening, and Wired was hiring, and I was a perfect fit. And that's what happened. So it's like putting yourself in the way of luck is kind of how I think of it.
Right. And the first book, which was the first book that you, was it the one of the private ones or was it?
No, the first book is I came out, you know, kind of big. And the first book I just did kind of something insanely ambitious. And it's this book here. It's called Valley of Genius. And so, you know, a lot of people write the history of this company or that company. I read those books. I love those books. But I decided to write the history of all the companies. And just because I thought what really the general reader needs is just one book. You know, I thought the general reader is only going to read one book on Silicon Valley, you know, and I wanted to write that book. And so I wrote what is now the most read and best reviewed history of kind of modern Silicon Valley, i.e., you know, I'm not talking about making wafers or making little electronics gadgets that I'm talking about, you know, consumer facing things, you know, video games, software.
I just want to say to the listeners, I've got a book actually on my Kindle here, and I started reading, and it's just so impressive, the level of detail and the quantity of data you need to go through to be able to put this thing together. It's impressive, and also the format is really, really interesting. Instead of you, Adam, being the writer describing the what happened in this history, you decided to go for another format, which is basically conversations and quotes, or I don't even know how to, you probably have to explain it better, of some of the key players defining and the legends basically of the Silicon Valley, and from their eyes, from their perspective, how it felt the whole kind of this period. So it's just really an amazing read. And Adam, I'm curious, why did you decide to go for this kind of format?
Yeah, so I work for my books in a very obscure genre of literary nonfiction that is called, you know, within in the trade, oral history. And what it is basically a documentary format. So there's not much actual writing in the book. What I do is I say, pick a pivotal moment. Let's say, the founding of Atari, which is, basically started the video game industry and arguably invented video games, as a genre. And I go, and I talked to the guy who founded Atari, his chief scientist, the funders, the secretary, you know, the early programmers, maybe even, you know, other people who are around. And I interview all of them, and I ask them to tell me, this famous startup story. And I interview each of them, and they each tell me the story, and then I lay the transcripts out and I cut them together like I would be cutting film together in a documentary film. And so what you get is like a stack of quotes, and as you read it, you hear everybody telling the story as kind of a chorus. It's like you're eavesdropping at like a reunion or a dinner party where everybody is competing and to tell this same amazing startup story, and interrupting each other and arguing with each other and kind of, celebrating on the page. And I do that for every important kind of consumer facing, you know, company, to document every moment, important moment in the Valley's kind of modern history. So I go from just before Atari with this research lab called Xerox PARC, which your readers may be familiar with, and even before that, this guy Doug Engelbart, who invented what we now know as the computer, to the death of Steve Jobs. And what's interesting, and I go from company to company, startup story to startup story, great, crazy moment where the Valley comes together. And what you see actually is a continuity, both of names, because people moved from company to company and they took their lessons with them. And you also see just the same kind of craziness over and over and over. And By reading all that history, first you'll be able to kind of have a conversation with people in Silicon Valley about what the hell happened, but you'll also kind of learn some lessons about what it really takes to build one of these companies, and really what, you know, and it's, you know, every book is like trying to give you these lessons, but this is, you know, this is the lessons without the buzzwords and the bullshit. It's the what actually happened, described by people who are actually there. And that's why it's important. And that's why I did it that way. I mean, it's hard to do. It's so much easier just to write it when you actually got to get the people who were there to tell their stories. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
Yeah, you said you've spent over 4 years on it, didn't you?
4 years, you know, like 60 hours a week. And, you know, most of it is trying to get these people to talk to me. Actually putting the book together is the pleasurable part. But yeah, I had to sell my house to complete it. So.
No way, man. So, yeah. so how do you get these people? Like some of the biggest shots, was it because you know for our book in very smaller scale, like you know, perform, we had to interview around 50 people as well. But again, you know, people, some of them running early stage startups, some of them bigger, so on. But it's been such a struggle just to get these interviews and to set them up, and then you talk to the assistant, and you some of them say just send a few questions, and he reply maybe, and they reply in 3 weeks. Then you get the questions, and the editor says, yeah, but it's not really grammatically correct like this. Why don't you? And then we send it back. Oh my God, it's been. And I'm just imagining how much it took for you. So many more, and people like with the. You know, like legends of Silicon Valley, basically. So what did it really take to, and do you have any specific example of somebody that was really hard to get, but like you couldn't let go? It's like, I need to get this person on the.
Oh God. I mean, you know, like, I mean, one thing, if you're a freelance writer or doing a book like this, you got to be comfortable putting yourself out there and making the ask and getting a no. You can't slow you down. You just got to go to the next person. And I got a lot of no's. But what is really remarkable is how many people, and I just emailed them a nice letter explaining what I was doing, said yes, I will talk to you. And why did they say yes? Well, I mean, it didn't hurt that the book was called Valley of Genius. So, it's also because, you know, a lot of these guys are familiar with my work, right? So it's a little bit of that. But I would say the biggest thing was really something that's fairly unique to Silicon Valley is that people are pretty open to someone with an idea or at least a good idea. Now, I'm not saying I had a good idea, but I came to them with an idea and they were like, yeah, history of Silicon Valley, you know, spoken by the people who are actually there. I think that's a good idea. I'm going to help you. I'll give you an hour of my time. And let's go for it. And yeah, it took sometimes months to get some of these people and a lot of times also just finding people I wanted to talk to. Like I found like I got the best stuff from like secretaries or like the chef, the first chef at Google was incredible. The kind of stuff I got. And you just wouldn't know if you read kind of the standard histories. You just gotta keep talking and keep networking. And ultimately, when you get down to the second or third level, like then people do have more time and they do open up and they introduce you to other people. So it's just shoe leather. It's just work. There's no magic to it. What can I say?
Well, actually, we have an interesting question coming from Eric Pastor. Eric, thanks for being with us. He's asking, Adam, what was your biggest challenge on writing your first book?
Oh, it was definitely access, you know. That, you know, I remember getting, I kind of did it in chronological order, and I remember getting to the Facebook chapter, and I was like, holy shit, like these guys are all still have jobs. I mean, a lot of the, in the first chapters, people were kind of retired and maybe they were even thinking about their legacy. And so they had a little time for me, but like, you know, you're in Facebook and it's like 2000, I was writing this in what, like, I don't know, 2016, let's say. And, you know, Facebook was huge back then. Like no one really had time for me. But you know, it turns out I'm, you know, I wormed my way into that community too, just by that, those were actually social connections. It turned out, you know, I knew some people and knew some people.
So, I think it's a great learning for any kind of industry, whether you are writing a book or you want to build a business. And I just love what you shared about getting some of the best insights from the chef, from the secretary, from, because we always going for the CEO, for the founder, right?
They're never that same. Interesting. They're never that interesting.
Look, we did the same for this book. Who is the CEO? Who's the founder? I wish I met you like, you know, like a couple of years ago, right? And you tell me, because like most of the information, like because you want to get the name, right? It's credible and it's coming from first. But then you think about it, it's like, yeah, but these people have more time. They can actually share some secrets and different opinion. It's amazing, man.
It's amazing what you'll get from the, and then, you know, you know, the guy who was the intern in one chapter turns out to be the CEO of the next, you know, big company. So there's this weird continuity.
What are some of the things that you didn't expect to find, but through going through all these interviews and material, you are like, wow, that's how things were.
How anarchic and utopian really almost all these startups were, and how you know, everybody who built any of the startups I talk about in this book, well, they're all incredibly young at the time, and so like there are always stories of like crazy parties and going to Burning Man, or, you know, taking meetings in hot tubs if it's like the 70s, or, you know, often, psychedelic drugs are involved. I think that's kind of a Bay Area thing, but I do think it, you know, and I think you can overstate it, but yeah, these people, they were geeky, but they were wild. So that was a surprise to me. And you know, and really often, almost in every case, they didn't start these companies for money. You know, it's like they started these companies kind of for fun or because it was kind of a neat hack. And then the money came.
But did that change in the 90s, let's say, or in the, you know, early 2000s?
So that, yeah, there was a thing called the dot-com boom and then bust, in which I document pretty clearly, where kind of the original hacker geeks who were kind of doing it for love and geeking out, had gotten rich and on this new thing called the internet or World Wide Web, more technically. And the Bay Area in San Francisco was kind of, you know, deluged by these human waves of like MBAs and you know, carpetbaggers and, you know, people, you know, coming for the gold rush. And you know, but what's interesting is like almost to a company, the companies of that era that were just founded on the basis of of like a I'm going to make money business plan, like never really hit the stratosphere. But, you know, like a company like Google, which was kind of late to the dot-com party, was not founded to make money, really. It was they were kind of forced to make a company because you know Page and Brin were sucking up all the bandwidth at Stanford, you know, power, you know, with people trying to get to like google.stanford.edu. And so they went out and the whole company started as kind of an intellectual exercise. Similarly, eBay, which, you know, was a dot-com company if there ever was one, that was put up, you know, basically because, you know, out of this kind of, as kind of an experiment in libertarianism, like, if you just put people together, can you trust them enough to just make a deal? And, you know, and that's the other thing I think that comes out. None of these companies, Facebook, Google, eBay, Atari, you know, Apple, the list goes on, were considered particularly promising. They were all considered either too wild or too utopian, or too idealistic, or just like dumb ideas in the very early days. And then, but so anybody who was looking just to cash in would have gone somewhere else. But people who are just geeking out on the technology and following their kind of own enthusiasms were the ones who ended up in a place where, you know, money started coming to them. And yeah, and that at that point you need to hire an MBA and these carpetbaggers. But so it's not like, you know, you need a lawyer when when you have a company. But
and people say history repeats itself, and we can learn so much from the lessons of history. And I wonder, because you've been researching, and actually you've been living, you know, some of these periods as well yourself. What are some of the lessons, like, for you? What made these leaders successful? If, as you said, oftentimes they were not the promising ones, right? So, mm-hmm. What made these companies? Was it pure passion? Was it some technical genius? What helped these people to really build these iconic companies?
Yeah, passion, technical genius, and being in the right place at the right time. You got two out of three. But I think the most important thing is kind of a gut feeling, is kind of being able to think for yourself. And I don't mean thinking for yourself as like being a contrarian or always being convinced that you're right or that you know the best. I mean more like a gut feeling, like, you know, getting into something in a deep way, and then just tuning out all the media, basically, and all the talking heads like us at the end of the day, and being able to like say, this is what I think is interesting, and this what motivates me, and it doesn't really matter whether I'm wrong or I'm making a wrong bet, because I just feel there's something that really gets me up in the morning about this, and, you know, I'm going to go for it. And it's those guys who win, right? It's probably those guys who lose too. Like, you know, there's a bias here. But, you know, you can't really lose if you're doing something for passion that you really think is truly interesting. I mean, I think it would help to to get yourself interested in a technical field as opposed to an artistic field. But that's because the odds are greater in a technical field than an artistic field. You want to play the odds if success per se, monetary success, is important to you. But if you can't find a passion in what you're doing, or you can't find something interesting about subject X that you can really like get into and nerd out on, then I don't think you're going to be wildly successful, and no matter how strategic you are. So I think strategic sense is overrated, and like kind of that, these feelings that we have, even in technical fields, are underrated.
And in here in Europe, we're looking at Silicon Valley, there's all these stories, and I have a feeling, especially young entrepreneurs, they look at the handful of companies that actually made it and they are successful. And there's this huge buzz around, like, we're going to build a unicorn and we're going to be like this 5, 20, 30 companies that are always in the, you know, top of the magazine and so on. And I think, and you mentioned failure, I think I want you to elaborate a little bit about what are actually the odds of building something successful when, I don't know how true it is, but they say that the suicidal rates in Silicon Valley also raising up, like the challenges with founders, difficulties with mental health, with depression, with all these kind of things. So I just want to, you know, hear from you, like maybe if you can paint a little bit of a more realistic picture of what it takes to build something successful. What are the odds of really building a company of this scale?
Oh, I mean, they're low. They're very low. There's a computer scientist. I'm going to tell a story. There's a computer scientist. I can get his name. We'll put it in the show notes. And he wrote a kind of a book. Anyway, but he was studying algorithms, basically algorithms for maze solving. And these algorithms, what you do is you write a basic algorithm, and then you kind of evolve them. This is called genetic programming, and so the programs kind of have some randomness in them, and so they can write the next iteration of algorithm, right? And it's just kind of a random, kind of just evolutionary type of process. And then you throw all these algorithms in your virtual maze and see which gets the farthest, right? And then you iterate on that and have you go through generations of algorithms, and then you see what you get, and you get an algorithm, a maze-solving algorithm, right, at the end of the day. And then this computer scientist said, well, what if instead of measuring how close each generation gets to the goal, why don't we measure how far it gets away from the entrance to the maze and iterate on that basis? And it turns out that if you measure success by how far you get away from where you were dropped into the maze, as opposed to the goal, you get better algorithms and faster maze solving algorithms, and you get fewer generations until you actually get to that goal. And he found out that this kind of metric where you measure success by how far you got from where you started, as opposed to how close you got to your goal, worked with every algorithm, genetic algorithm, whether you're solving a maze or you're having kind of robots trying to learn how to walk, or, you know, any of the classic kind of tests in computer science. And then he realized that this is not, so this is a scientific result, that it's just better to judge algorithms on how far they got from where they started. Even if you're looking to do something, right? Make something happen. And he believes, and I believe, that that is true for people organizing their lives too. Like, so if you want to be a billionaire, okay, to just boil this down, you can't try to be a billionaire. If you want to have to found a unicorn, you can't try to make a unicorn, because then you're just copying the last guy. And hey, guess what? Unicorns are unique. You can't make a new unicorn by just trying to find the unicorn blueprint. The point is that there are unicorns. They're singular. Each one is different. So the way you do it is by forgetting about unicorns and just doing the next most interesting things from where you're at, and then keep doing the next most interesting thing, following your gut, not some blueprint that you read in a book or you got from a conference. You gotta look inside and take what you know and what you've been working on and say, what do I think is the most exciting next step in whatever direction? And guess what? It turns out that, well, algorithms that work that way are more successful. And if you read my book, Valley of Genius, you'll find out that people who work that way are more successful. None of these people who made these companies that made Silicon Valley great decided, I'm going to make $1 zillion in a great company. They decided to do the next most interesting thing. They knew technology because they were technologists and technology nerds. And then they see the adjacent possible. They're like, oh, that's fucking interesting. Let's do that. And then they did it again. And then they end up in a really interesting place. And often in a place where they can do all those things that the books claim are just a matter of doing. They can monetize, they can cash out, they can be successful. But there's no formula for doing that. It's kind of this meta formula, this formula about formulas, in which you got to just judge, you got to know, you got to be soaking in whatever field it is, and then you got to think like, what do I think is cool? I'm going to do that.
Love it, man. Thanks for sharing. I think it's going to give so much value to some people now on the journey. And yeah, following up to this, I'm curious, what's your take on, you talk a lot about follow your gut, follow your passion. And founders, I think, are struggling to figure out, how far should I follow my passion and build a product or the service that I believe in, as opposed to serving the demands of the market? Like, where is the sweet spot? Mm. How do we find a place where we do what we are passionate about, but we also resolve some customer pain out there? Find a market that's potentially could be scalable if we want to grow the company big.
Yeah, well, look, I'm not sure asking a writer that question will really give you a good answer, but I'm a big believer in markets, because they tell you stuff. The universe is talking to you every day, and that is never truer than when you're trying to sell someone something to make a living, And so, for me, after I wrote Valley of Genius, I thought I'd be writing more big books that you'd go to the bookstore and find my name. But what I found is that people that I either in kind of my social network, which is overlaps with this kind of network that I built, reporting Valley of Genius, started to just come to me and ask me to help them with their books. And at first I was like, no, that's not me. I, I'm this thing. I'm this author. And there is a way to be an author. You write your first book, and then you get advance on your second book, and then, you know, ad infinitum, and then, you know, and then if you're really great, you know, you get a TV show, or I don't know how it ends up, but I resisted it for a while, and then I realized, you know, the market was talking to me, the universe was talking to me, and I pivoted, and I said, you know what, I'm going to try it out. I'm going to try to do this new thing. I'm going to write, essentially, to dumb it down, versions of my first book, Valley of Genius, but for, you know, high net worth individuals who have a need for their own book. And I am happy to say it's worked out fabulously. I have like a whole kind of market all to myself. I get to do everything I love about writing with nothing, all the, and I don't have to do any of the stuff that I don't like. And, you know, I've now written two and a half of these kind of follow-ups to Valley of Genius. And, you know, some of them are not available. Like it's, you know, a book with a circulation of, you know, maybe 100, but, you know, that doesn't matter to me because I get the same or more kind of, remuneration in actual money and in love from these other books. And so so how do you know was the question, if it's working? Well, you know, the universe does tell you, and you got to listen to the universe. It's not about being stubborner than the next guy. You know, you look at, I mean, you know, the classic story of Steve Jobs. He was definitely listening to what the universe was telling him. You know, first he came out and, you know, we'll do the very short version. First he did a computer with Woz, and Woz wanted to do a game machine, right? So they built the Apple II, which had color and sound and joystick ports, because Woz wanted to program clones of Atari video games, right? Literally, that is the spec for the Apple II. And then Jobs realized that the real killer app for the Apple II was people, you know, business people running spreadsheets on them with the early spreadsheet software in the Apple II, because it was had all this kind of extra capacity as a game machine. Also, was the best to run these early spreadsheets on. So the next thing Jobs tried to do was like a business machine. And he went to Xerox PARC, which is, you know, automating the office, and looked at what they were doing and kind of cloned the Alto to create the Macintosh, which was supposed to kind of be for businessmen. Now it was made by a bunch of 20-something girls, so it was cute and fun and everything, but it was explicitly a business machine, like the Lisa Junior, I guess you could call it, Lisa being the Apple's failed business machine. And then yeah, he gets kind of fired, goes into the wilderness, and he comes back, and he creates a machine, you know, in the .com, you know, the .com Apple was about to die, Jobs created the iMac, which was, you know, if you wanted to get on the internet real cheap, you could just buy an iMac. The I stood for internet, right? And it just plugged in. You didn't need to buy an extra modem. And then after that, you know, he realized MP3s were happening with Napster on the internet. And he creates a MP3 player. And that evolves stepwise into an iPhone. Like, Jobs, the most stubborn guy, the guy who everybody says stuck to his guns, was always did that, but he was always listening to the market as well. He was always kind of talking to the universe and saying, not what do I want, but what do people want? And so you can't just lock yourself in a room and make it all about yourself. You got to get out there and figure out whether, you know, what, you know, what you're interested in is what people want. But, you know, a lot of times you got to build it first to see. So that's where the passion comes in the vision.
And Adam, you mentioned universe a number of times, and actually Eric has another question. Adam, if you appear tomorrow in a Palero universe where you didn't exist it, but everything else is the same, what would you decide to do with the rest of your life?
Oh, I definitely, wait a minute. Let me just read what this says on the screen, because I don't think I understand the question. Where I didn't exist. Oh, well, I'd probably do the same thing. I'm very happy with what I'm doing, and I hope I would recognize that there's like a vacuum called the old Adam Fisher and try to mold myself into the new, you know, and fit that vacuum. Like, I think I am perfectly suited for what I am doing right now. So I don't know. Now, if I appeared in a universe where there was another Adam Fisher and he was filling my niche, then what would I do? That's the question. That's the stumper. Maybe, you know, I often think that if it weren't for a couple, you know, odd events in my life, I would have ended up programming, going to Stanford and programming computers and actually being an engineer. I mean, I think in most parallel universes, I would have ended up as a software engineer. And I'm just trapped in some odd one where somehow I became a writer.
But you're a writer and you've also written, I'm gonna wait you for.
Oh, let me just turn this guy off. Or... That's like Google Voice, but yeah, close. Google Here Voice, we are, right. Back.
So, but you're not in the Palero universe anyway, and you're a writer, and you wrote a book about designing ideas with a world-class designer. What was the motivation behind that one, and what's the main kind of message of the book, so to say?
Eve Bihar, I don't know if your readers are aware, but he's kind of the guy who connects kind of Europe with Silicon Valley, like the European sensibilities. He grew up in Europe and kind of as an artsy kid, and he went to kind of art school, design school in California, and he came to Silicon Valley in the early 90s to be a product designer, an industrial designer, they called it there then. And today he is the guy that you go to if you have a new product and you want it to be beautiful, to be designed, you know, after, you know, post iPhone, everybody in Silicon Valley realized that design was really important, you know. So he designed the first Bluetooth speaker. He designed the first kind of wristband that collected health data. He designed, just a million things. And he, you know, why did I do that book? I did that book because we've been friends forever. I met him when he was just starting out. And he came to me and said, Adam, I'm 10 years late on a book contract. I need your help. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And we kind of co-wrote it. But I took his story and organized it and put it into chapters. You know, I helped him with his kind of design manifestos. He designed everything. Basically, he designed everything. He was responsible for all the imagery, and I was basically responsible for all the words. And it came out just maybe a month ago. It's this beautiful kind of very thick kind of coffee table book that has all his important projects and the story behind them, and then, you know, his kind of bigger ideas about the meaning of it all.
What was the name of the book?
It's called Eve Bahar Designing Ideas.
And who should get a copy of this book? Who are the people that would benefit of reading it?
Anybody who's involved in kind of the UI or design side of hardware or software should definitely get the book. Because if you are involved in that, you probably know who this guy is already. He's the guy. You know, it's just a lot of lessons in there. It's like the same idea of my larger history of Silicon Valley. It's like you can learn a lot by just going back and seeing how the evolution of the kind of the birth of these iconic products. You know, you can just learn a lot about the larger process of design going forward. It's not just historical value. This is how you learn, as you watch people doing it. And if you weren't there, this is the next best thing.
So everybody, make sure to go check out Adam Fisher's books. We spoke a lot about Valley of Genius, but then there's this other book that just came out. So you might be one of the first people in your country to get a copy of the book. So make sure to go check it out for sure. And Adam, final question, since this podcast is called Productivity Mastery, and I admire your work ethic, I admire the quality of the things that you produce. So for my audience, I think it's going to be interesting. What are your personal productivity habits? What helps you to stay at the top of your game?
Well, as I said, it's all about what some people call ass power, right? And that means the power to get your ass in that seat at 9, whether you're hungover or tired or grumpy or whatever, and just start working. Even if you're not feeling productive, even if you're literally not productive, just moving that ball forward. That's the first thing. The second thing is to not end up tired, grumpy, or hungover when you start. And that means, you know, that there needs to be an end to your workday, right? My end happens to be 5 o'clock. I go 9 to 5. But at 5, like, I do things to take care of myself. I work out a lot. I eat healthy. I get a lot of sleep. I make sure I have laughs with my family and my friends. And, you know, and that gets me in the seat again the next morning feeling pretty good. And that cycle is very productive. And so if you want an exciting career with lots of exciting accomplishments that gets guys like, you know, gets you on a podcast, I guess, your life in a way is a little boring and it's about routine. But I gotta say, although it kind of in some way, you know, it might appear boring. I'm not going out and partying every night. You develop this kind of interior life that's very exciting. I'm very excited to wake up each day and work on my projects. And it's that kind of excitement that people could feel when they finally kind of read what I wrote. And it's also true with like software. Like when people are excited, you know, to make these businesses, like it translates into the product, whether it's the Macintosh being like obviously cool, or, you know, a piece of software, like, I don't know, the original Netscape or something. People can tell that the people who created it were excited and into it because it just feels different. And that can't be engineered in the narrow sense. It can only be engineered in this larger sense where you create these patterns that give you the bandwidth to do your best work, and get rid of the distractions and just focus on the one thing that you're really kind of, that your gut tells you is the right thing.
And it might take some digging, and I love that you have your own routine, 9 to 5. You love your family. You love to spend time with the family. So you didn't fall into the trap of, I got to work 12, 14 hours.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Sorry.
But some people do, though. And just want to finish with a story. I met this guy a few years ago. My background is for movie production. So I used to produce movies and videos. And I met this guy who was was the lead designer of a Cartoon Network show called Adventure Time. I don't know if you've seen the show, but it's a lot of, it's really fun, also for adults. But basically he was really, really hustling to make it in the industry. He designed the first two seasons of the show, like literally like a lead designer, made some money. But he told me, Stoyan, I was really self-aware because I went through some struggles early in my life. So I knew what I want. So I basically retired at 30. I everybody was like, after you do these things, like everybody wants to get you on board. And it's like I bought a forest in Vermont, like a 5-acre like kind of forest. I built a house on my tree. I lived there with my wife, with my kid. We built stuff all day long. I'm working 15 hours a week right now. I have Wi-Fi there, right? Like I'm very active in the local community of this, like a nearby town of 5,000 people, right? But it's just, I love to build stuff. I love to spend 2 hours in the morning to walk with my son and nobody disturbs me. I have no phone. This is me. And then I go and I will take like projects that I like to do that they pay me really good for. And I don't have much of expense. I don't want to be rich. So everybody needs to find their own thing.
Oh yeah, no. I totally agree with him. And if I could do that, I might. I'm not in a position. I haven't. That kind of success hasn't found me where I could just like drop out and retire.
But some people, it's not a success, right? For some people, they're driven, man. They're fired. It's not about the money. They just want to wake up and build stuff for 60, 70, 80 hours. That's fine.
Yeah.
If you're still
raring to go, you're probably in your 20s if you're doing that. But yeah, go for it. But, you remember, it's like, you can do it and then wake up refreshed the next day. And you can also do it and just be burnt out the next day. Only you know the difference, right? That's why there's no actual formula. It's like, make sure you're actually putting in the time,
Amen. Thank you so much, Adam, for being on the show. Once again, guys, go check out Adam's books, Designing Ideas, and Valley of Genius. You can find them on Amazon, on Kindle. So it's pretty easy to find them pretty much. But definitely go follow Adam as well. And thank you so much for being with us until the end of the show, for following us. Those of you who have not subscribed yet, you can find Productivity Mastery Podcast on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Really help us to reach even more people. And lots of more exciting guests like Adam are on the way. Just next week, we're going to have Lubomila Yordanova, who is the founder and CEO of a company called Plan A for the Planet. We're going to talk about climate change and what can we do about it. It's next Thursday, so make sure to tune in live or listen to the podcast afterwards. Thank you so much for listening and see you again at the next episode of Productivity Mastery.
Thank you guys for listening. And if you're looking for somebody to help you step up your team performers and boost your productivity, make sure to check out stoyanyankov.com for online workshop solutions and programs designed to help you go through the current situation in a smoother manner. Stay safe and keep moving forward.